bipartisan bill aimed at bringing down housing costs by building more homes is poised to be approved by Congress as soon as this evening.
We'll explain what's in it and break down how it would work.
For Tuesday, June 23rd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Supreme Court recently limited how people are eligible to get out of federal prison early.
Ahead, we will hear how that ruling will affect inmates.
These are indefensibly long sentences, and they need to be corrected.
Plus, the latest from the National Mall, where July 4th celebrations are running headlong into contentious politics.
And the Senate has voted to take away President Trump's power to wage war with Iran.
Both houses are on the record saying this is an illegal war and you got to stop it.
We'll hear from Democratic Senator Tim Kaine about the vote.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Congress has directed President Trump to remove U.S. armed forces from his hostilities against Iran. The Senate approved a House-passed resolution this afternoon by a vote of 50 to 48. The resolution lacks the force of law and does not need to be signed by the president, but it reflects growing concerns in the Republican-led Congress about the war and Trump's interim deal to end it. NPR's Eric McDaniel reports.
Congress has the power to declare war and regulate military conflict. It hasn't been able to do that, though, for the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran. The Trump administration hasn't asked for approval or a declaration of war in contravention of the law. This resolution is not legally binding and not likely to change President Trump's behavior, but the message is clear. A majority of lawmakers, including a handful of Republicans, disapprove of the Iran war, as does a large majority of the American public. This vote comes as Vice President Vance is hashing out the details of an agreement to end the war, the initial terms of which have been roundly rebuked by members of both parties. Eric McDaniel, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump visited a Mack Trucks factory in Pennsylvania today in his first major public event outside Washington since he signed an interim deal to end the Iran war.
You are the men and women who put your pride and spirit into those beautiful words stamped on every Mack truck that said, made in the USA. It's made in the USA.
The trip to the suburb of Allentown came as he works to shift attention away from the Iran war and high gas prices as the November midterm elections draw closer. The area could be pivotal to Republicans holding narrow control of the House. Freshman Republican Congressman Ryan McKenzie is hoping to hold on to the district Democrats have targeted to flip. Three states are holding primaries today, including New York, where Democrats hope one race will help them retake the U.S. House. Reporter Steve Kastenbaum says voters in New York's 17th congressional district are deciding who will face Republican Mike Lawler in November.
Five candidates are vying for the opportunity to face the incumbent in a district where registered Democrats outnumber Republicans. In the working-class city of Peekskill, retiree Mike Callahan said affordability is a major concern for voters.
Everybody is really hurting and hurting with prices.
Moderates hold the key to winning this district, and Democratic Party strategists want to avoid making this race about President Trump. But voter Stacey Jackson said there's no separating the incumbent from the president.
He's the epitome of people who claim to not be MAGA but are MAGA.
The polls close at 9 p.m. For NPR News, I'm Steve Kastenbaum in New York.
And New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani has backed far-left candidates. The outcome of those races are seen as a gauge on his influence. Big tech companies dragged down major U.S. stock indexes today. The S&P 500 fell 1.4%. The Nasdaq fell 2.2%. This is NPR News from Washington. The Supreme Court has ruled that ExxonMobil can sue Cuban companies in American courts over property that was seized after Fidel Castro took power more than 65 years ago. The outcome could be an additional lever for the Trump administration to exert pressure on Cuba, which is already being squeezed by a U.S. oil embargo. The Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has hit a part of the world famous for its gorilla population. NPR's Gabriela Emanuel reports on efforts to protect the primates.
Fatality rates among gorillas can reach as high as 98%. In the early 2000s, about a third of the world's gorilla population was lost due to Ebola. Don Zimmerman is a wildlife veterinarian at the Smithsonian Institution.
Populations likely don't recover for decades, and genetically, they are impacted for centuries. It is mind-blowing.
Gorillas are thought to get the virus from bats or from contact with infected humans. That's why in the DRC, the Virunga National Park has tasked about 200 rangers with ensuring there isn't any contact between people and primates. Still, the head of the park says his main priority is stopping the virus's spread among humans. Gabriella Emmanuel, NPR News.
An Australian air conditioner cleaner and honorary town crier has been recognized as the world's loudest person. Guinness World Records acknowledged that Joseph McGrail Beta yelled now at 122.4 decibels. That broke Northern Ireland school teacher Annalisa Flanagan's records of screaming quiet in 1994. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It's 4:06. Lows tonight near 50 with continued rain and possible thunderstorms. And tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms continue with highs in the upper 60s. Looking ahead to Thursday, mostly sunny, highs 72 to 75. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local news stories and conversations at kaxe.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Congress is expected to pass the largest housing affordability bill in decades today. On Monday, the Senate approved the 21st Century Road to Housing Act with overwhelming and pretty rare bipartisan support. The House is set to vote on the bill this evening. Here to tell us what the bill is meant to do is NPR's personal finance reporter, Stephen Bisaha. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, good to be with you, Scott.
So is this shocking and rare proof that Washington can agree on something?
Yeah, you know, when that thing is that homes are unaffordable, yeah, they could agree.
Okay.
This is a widespread problem across the country. Like, to afford the typical home on the market in the U.S., a family has to make about $117,000 a year. That is according to real estate research company Redfin. And that is tens of thousands of dollars more than most households do make. You know, mortgage rates have really risen over the past few years. The national average now is about 6.5%. And then there's the specific problem this bill tries to address. The U.S. does not have enough houses to keep up with demand. I asked Gina Kenny, an economist at Villanova University, about this.
We can talk all day about sort of interest rates and incomes, but really, if you want to see prices come down, you really have to increase the supply of housing.
And some estimates put the shortage between 4 and 5 million homes.
There are so many different approaches to try and fix this problem. Walk me through what this legislation would actually do.
Well, you know, lawmakers in Washington, they can't just order up millions of new homes to be built. That is the private sector's job. But I did speak with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who co-sponsored this bill with Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, and she put it this way.
There's a lot that the federal government can do. It's just been more than 30 years since the federal government has done anything but sit by and say, damn, price of housing sure has gone up. Finally, we are actually moving.
So a few things governments can do. It can make it more enticing for home builders to build and make it easier for home buyers to buy. And instead of doing this with like one big change, the bill does it in dozens of different ways.
To the point that there's more than 40 parts of this bill.
Yeah.
Give me some of the highlights.
Well, one big flashy part of it is comes from, you know, President Trump and other politicians. They've accused corporations of buying up single family houses and, you know, outcompeting with families and driving up prices. So this bill bans large investors and companies from buying up more homes. If one of these groups owns at least 350 single family homes, they would not be allowed to buy up any more. You know, ultimately, this may not have a huge effect because these investors right now, they make up just a tiny fraction of the housing market. But there are a lot of other things the bill tries to do, too, like, you know, speeding up construction. One provision streamlines environmental reviews for building homes between existing homes. Another creates a grant program for communities to develop pattern books of, you know, like pre-approved housing designs, so builders won't need to go through as many approvals to get this up to code. The bill also encourages local governments to speed up the process by giving more federal dollars to places that build more.
Politicians like to claim they have fixed a problem. Will this legislation actually make housing more affordable?
Well, don't expect houses to suddenly become cheaper overnight. The bill streamlines the federal side of permitting, but, you know, local government still has a much bigger say when it comes to construction. And builders are facing other challenges, like high costs of labor and supplies. But this is the largest affordability bill to come out of Congress in decades. Lots of experts I spoke to thought that this really could move the needle on affordability.
NPR's Stephen Bisaha, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
The Great American State Fair begins in D.C. this week as part of the country's 250th anniversary celebrations. It is bringing a Ferris wheel, carnival food, and hundreds of exhibits to the National Mall, even as some state leaders have decided not to participate. NPR's Rachel Treisman joins us now to talk about what we can expect. Hi there.
Hello.
All right, Rachel, this sounds like quite the production. What more will the fair entail?
Right. So the action starts with a kickoff rally on Wednesday night and will run daily through July 10th. Now, this is a free rain or shine all day event that will span 10 blocks of the National Mall. Organizers are promising military flyovers, movie screenings, and even a daily rodeo. They say there will be over 150 pavilions, so one for every U.S. state and territory, and then others run by a wide range of companies and agencies. We're talking John Deere, NASA, Meta, and many others. Each of the 16 days of the fair will have its own theme. So, for example, there will be two Maha Mondays. And, of course, July 4th is the big Independence Day celebration.
Okay, so there will be booths for every state, but as I understand, not all states are involved. How's that work?
Exactly. We've confirmed at least 10 state governments are not participating directly, including Vermont, Illinois, North Carolina, and Hawaii. So they're not spending state funds on their exhibits or sending any staff to D.C. Organizers of the fair say all of the states will still be represented. It's just that for some of them, their booth may be run by a tourism board or a company or organization from that state. Most of the states that opted out are blue states, but they say they were making a purely financial decision. Here's Catherine Volman, a spokesperson for Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont.
Getting staffers down to D.C., housing them, feeding them, and with the booth and everything that that would entail, the estimated budget was at least $100,000.
Other states estimated costs as high as $500,000 without any federal subsidies. And they all said they wanted to focus their limited resources on state celebrations, though governors in Massachusetts and Oregon also voiced political concerns, including that the event has become too partisan.
Who's behind the event?
A group called Freedom 250, which describes itself as nonpartisan but is aligned with the White House. And it says both private and public funds are paying for the fair. President Trump created Freedom 250 last year through an executive order. And some critics saw that as an effort to bypass a commission that Congress had formed for this exact same reason a decade ago. So we now have two groups. America 250 is mostly planning community-level events like block parties and concerts. And Freedom 250 is behind a lot of high-profile D.C. events. So the State Fair, also the White House UFC fight, and an auto race coming up in August.
And just to close with some historical context here, how has America celebrated big birthdays in the past?
Yeah, I talked to a bunch of historians about this, and there's been a huge variety. For example, Philadelphia hosted a hugely successful World's Fair in 1876 and a sort of disastrous one in 1926. This year, there are tons of national and local celebrations happening across the country. And of course, many U.S. cities are hosting the World Cup. There are not any soccer matches happening in D.C., but there is a viewing zone on the National Mall right near the State Fair.
NPR's Rachel Treisman, thanks.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court recently limited how people in federal prison can get out early. The court said inmates are not eligible for compassionate release simply because they are serving much longer sentences than the punishments they would have received today. For some people, that decision will have major consequences. NPR Supreme Court correspondent Kerry Johnson talked with one of them.
Anthony Bailey sat down to talk last week after a long shift driving through stormy weather in Indianapolis.
I'm a people person, and I know how to interact with them, you know. If they having a bad day, they get on my coach. Hey, like, I was having a bad day today, but you made my day.
Bailey's now 61. He's been working as a bus driver for the city since a judge freed him from prison 2 years ago. Bailey spent 27 years inside for armed robbery and two carjackings. He committed those crimes on the same day, September 3rd, 1997. Prosecutors said in court papers his crimes were serious and put several people in danger.
Something that I totally regret will never happen again, ever in life.
In 2024, a judge found Bailey presented extraordinary and compelling reasons to get out of prison. The judge said Bailey would have faced far less time for those same offenses if he broke the law today, because Congress has since lightened some harsh penalties. But lawmakers did not make that change retroactive to apply to people already serving time in prison. The Supreme Court decision means Bailey's punishment is not extraordinary or compelling enough for early release. The court majority said the compassionate release program is supposed to be for individuals with severe illness or old age. John Gleason has been working for years to help people get out of prison.
These are indefensibly long sentences, and they need to be corrected.
He's a former federal judge who launched a pro bono program to help people like Bailey. They're mostly black men who carried guns while they committed other crimes. Prosecutors added severe mandatory penalties, stacking the punishments, even if no shots were fired, to build prison terms of 50 or 60 years. That's what happened in the case of Anthony Bailey. Miriam Khanna's one of his lawyers. She says Bailey has already served more time than most people convicted of federal murder.
He, you know, has a stable, happy life and is a really productive member of society. So, I mean, the idea that he poses a danger is completely farcical.
Justice Department appeals were pending in about a dozen cases like Bailey's when the Supreme Court ruled in late May. Prosecutors now signal they could move soon to send Bailey back to serve the rest of his long sentence. They declined comment and pointed NPR to court filings in the case. If he's sent back, Bailey won't be eligible for release until 2050, when he's well into his 80s.
I'll abide by the law. Okay, is this what y'all decide? Okay, just got to keep fighting.
Before the Supreme Court decision, Bailey'd been getting good marks from his probation officer and planning for early release from probation this fall. Now he's not sure where he'll be in September. He's making the most of his time now, enjoying family barbecues and card games in the park and showing his little grandson the ropes.
He's a worker. You know, everything I do, he sit there and just watch, and then we washing the car or we take it to trash out. Come on.
He's teaching the boy how to mow the lawn and enjoy some French fries at McDonald's. Carrie Johnson, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:18. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer will look back at his nature notes for this state. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Continued chance for rain overnight with lows near 50.
On today's date, June 23rd, 1995, the tall meadow rue is finally beginning to bloom. It has a cousin, the early meadow rue, which is already done blooming, but this one holds off till later in the summer, and it grows quite tall. I've seen some of these plants 5, 6, 7 feet tall, and they have these long, dangly kind of flowers. They remind me of little ornaments on chandeliers. The flowers themselves sort of open up, and then hanging down are these, I'd say a dozen or more little, glass objects hanging, little glass prisms hanging at the base of a chandelier. That's kind of how these flowers look. They're not something you're going to see from a long way off, but there are a lot of these flowers, and there are a lot of these little prism-like structures that hang down from those flowers, and so it's pretty easy. If you're wandering in the woods or walking along the edge of your yard, it's pretty easy to find the tall meadow rue.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Penn Medicine, committed to innovation since 1751. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine is working to change lives. From Bank of America, sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, dedicated to offering solutions to help businesses win, locally and globally. More at bankofamerica.com/gamechangers. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The Senate has voted to take away President Trump's power to wage war with Iran. It happened this afternoon. It's about the 10th time Democrats and some Republicans have tried to push this resolution through. The vote is largely symbolic because while it's headed to President Trump's desk, he's almost certainly going to veto the measure. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine has been pushing for a vote like this for years and joins us now. Hi, Senator.
Scott, good to be with you.
What changed?
Well, I think what changed is as the war went on, and we're in like about day 110, the consequences mounted and stacked up. 13 U.S. service members dead, thousands of Iranian civilians, probably more than $50 billion already paid out of the U.S. Treasury for the war with more to come, and Americans suffering by paying more at the gas pump. That's also in excess of $50 billion that people have paid more for gas since February 28. And so eventually the combined weight of these consequences convinced Republicans, especially during this fragile ceasefire, look, before you come back and start up this bombing campaign again, we're telling you this is illegal and you need us in order to continue this war.
I mean, the pushback is that, you know, people have noted that if Senator McConnell, Republican, had been in the chamber today, this measure likely would have failed to get again. This is a narrow passage. Is this a milestone moment for you?
It is a milestone for me because, remember, this is both houses are Republican majority. And both houses, Republican majority, have now said to this president, this war is illegal and you got to stop it. Now, look, we don't expect the president is just going to follow Congress. But the president knows what it means when he starts losing votes, not only of Democrats, but in his own party. What it means is people are listening to their constituents. Their constituents are telling them this war is deeply unpopular, never should have been started to begin with, quit punishing me at the gas pump. And that message the president will hear loud and clear.
I want to talk to you about the Iran war first, and then more specifically the war powers issue. On the Iran war, what do you see as the most realistic off-ramp here? Because as you know, the Trump administration is locked in these negotiations. The concessions they seem to be getting from Iran are unpopular with Trump's Republican base and seem to quickly not stick. What to you is the best way forward realistically?
Well, I do think a negotiated end to the war. The memorandum of understanding had 14 points to it. It's vastly inferior to the JCPOA that President Obama and America's allies negotiated over a period of about 2 years, and yet it's still better than a stupid war. And so I want the administration to stay at the table and find the path forward. The deal is likely to have to be submitted to Congress pursuant to a bill that I wrote 10 years ago, the Iran Nuclear Review Act, and Congress will then get to examine it and weigh in on it. But look, a bad peace deal is better than a foolish and illegal war. And so stay at the table and try to get as much agreement as we can with Iran and don't restart, you know, a foolish bombing campaign.
More broadly, you have been leading this at times quixotic, I would say, push to get some sort of narrowing of war powers resolutions in this post-9/11 era for a long time now under Democratic
yes.
presidents, under Republican presidents. Republicans and Democrats have now sent a bill to the president's desk. What is the next step for you to get a success that a president will sign into law?
Well, it is the case. When I came here in 2013, I checked off against President Obama, who was a friend of mine, when he wanted to use the military without congressional authorization. I said, you know, you're proposing something good, but you can't do it without Congress. And whether it was President Obama or President Trump term one, President Biden, President Trump term two, I've said this is the most important power that Congress has. I'm the father of a Marine. We shouldn't be sending our kids into harm's way unless Congress does the job and authorizes. So now we have done what the War Powers Resolution says Congress can do to stop an illegal war. And I have to step back now and say, once we've done this, I don't know that I need to do it two or three times. There are other things that I want to do. I would like to do a bill that would update the War Powers Resolution from the 1974 version to make it more applicable to war circa 2026. You know, you didn't have drones. War in the 1970s was between nations. It wasn't fundamentally about non-state terrorist groups. So a number of things have changed. Is an AI attack on a country's infrastructure? Is that war? Does it have to be a bomb, or can it be a cyber attack? So I do have longer term goals with respect to the War Powers Resolution. But for now, I want to just make sure everybody understands what a big deal it is when in the middle of this conflict, Congress of two Republican houses have looked the president in the face and said, this war is illegal. It's time to stop it.
That is Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia. Thank you so much.
Absolutely, Scott.
For over a week, teams and boats have been traversing the 750-mile span of water between Washington State and Alaska, and they've been doing it with no engines. It's part of a human and wind-powered competition known as the Race to Alaska. The winning team crossed the finish line last night, and KRBD's Hunter Morrison was there to greet them.
Welcome to Ketchikan!
It's a rare sunny evening at a boat harbor in the heart of downtown Ketchikan. A few dozen spectators cheer on the northbound Nutters, a team of four men aboard a yellow, multi-hull sailboat that's gliding toward the dock. Nigel Oswald steps off the vessel and rings a bell, marking his team's completion of the journey. A bystander hands him a well-deserved beer. Oswald says the race started long before hitting the water.
It was a huge amount of boat work, prep and planning and logistics. And to know that we hadn't screwed it up and everything worked and we got here, it was just a huge emotional relief, more than winning or not winning.
The route from Washington to Alaska traces the Inside Passage, a network of waterways weaving through the islands of the Pacific Northwest coast. It can be an unpredictable and rough trip, with rain, wind, and heavy currents. If people need to be rescued, it can take hours or days.
Because it's so unpredictable, you just don't know where you're going to be next and how long it's going to take to get there.
That's Jean Gusev with Northwest Maritime, a nonprofit devoted to educating and engaging people with nautical culture. They sponsor the race. Gusev is also a former race champion.
It's a lot of reading the weather in motion and making calls as you're going through the course.
The first place winners get a $10,000 cash prize. Second place gets a set of steak knives. Oswald and his winning team wanted to take on the challenge of the race to see what they were made of. And they're proud they were able to finish in a boat built for much shorter journeys.
Getting that boat that isn't designed for this kind of thing with these guys to here just feels awesome.
This year, over 60 teams entered the race. They're expected to trickle in or tap out over the next few weeks. For NPR News, I'm Hunter Morrison in Ketchikan, Alaska.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to People Powered, KAXE, and All Things Considered. It is 4:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a moment, National Native News, and 1 hour from now, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Boreal Brushworks Painting in Bemidji. Since 2009, Boreal Brushworks has provided full-service interior and exterior painting services throughout northern Minnesota. More information about estimates and services at borealbrushworkspainting.com. Lows tonight near 50 with continued rain and thunderstorms possible. Southeast winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. For tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms continue, mostly cloudy with highs in the upper 60s. And for Thursday, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 70s. Walker Bay Theater presents the comedy Four Old Broads. Shows are at 7 o'clock every Friday and Saturday in June, plus Sunday matinee at 3. Tickets available at the door or by calling Walker Bay Theater.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. The nation's 575 federally recognized tribes are now eligible for conservation grants from the National Park Service. And as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrasio reports, a new digital tool is designed to help them navigate the bureaucracy.
The Land and Water Conservation Fund has been around since 1964.
It receives about $900 million each year from offshore oil and gas royalties, not taxpayer dollars, to support conservation and outdoor recreation nationwide. And yet I had never heard of the program.
Starlin Rose Miller is from the Little Shell Chippewa Tribe of Montana. She's with the nonprofit Wilderness Society, which launched the new online hub.
Tribal governments are so busy. We thought if we could put a hub up, designed in partnership with indigenous-led orgs, agencies, nonprofits, that it could be helpful.
The fund has aided more than 47,000 projects in nearly every county nationwide. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrasio.
High energy costs are a fact of life in remote, rural Alaska with few easy answers. A brother and sister team from Bethel recently won top honors at an innovation competition hosted from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, they are committed to being part of the solution.
Fraternal twins Drini and Viosa Palumbi have more in common than the same birthday. So far, their education and career paths have followed side by side. The brother and sister graduated from high school with college credit gained through the ANSEP program and are currently studying mechanical engineering at the University of Alaska Anchorage. The Palumbi twins are busy advancing a prototype of a device that attaches to home boilers and aims to reduce heating costs in cold weather climates.
Essentially, it takes heat that would have been wasted by the boiler and just repurposes it to heat incoming water.
Their Arctic Heat Recovery System design earned the top prize and $21,000 at the Alaska Innovation Competition hosted by the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The same day, the pair celebrated their 20th birthday.
During the finals of that competition, we still had finals for our semester course, and stresses were high. It was a lot of good news that day.
This summer, the Palumbis are both in Washington, D.C., interning with a wildlife conservation nonprofit. In their off hours, they're plugging away at their prototype.
On my table right in front of me, we have a couple thermocouples and sensors. We're in two separate apartments, but we take turns whose room carries all the junk.
Drini says the heat recovery concept is nothing new, but that it's so far been focused on large-scale commercial applications.
I guess a lot of people just don't see a profit margin in developing it for Alaskan citizens, like residents, to use, but we're not really in it for the profit. We're in it because it's clean, it saves oil, it saves money, it saves pollutants from entering the atmosphere. It's just good all around.
Friends and family in Bethel, where fuel prices have recently spiked due to the war in Iran, are eager to be the first to test the device. The Palumbis say it has the potential to save homeowners thousands of dollars per year. They say the money they earned at this year's Arctic Innovation Competition is going directly into making the heat recovery system a reality. The second-generation Albanian-Americans credit their mother for pushing them to apply together for the competition.
One of the core values is being like very family oriented. So I guess that's always been why we've been like gravitated towards doing the same things, because we've always been close.
Both say they could end up specializing in different engineering fields down the road. But for now, they say they're enjoying being a team as long as they can. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Skuktash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Ye.
Hear that? Tribal college faculty do so much, one can't say it all here. Nothing but respect. Visit mosttheroughjobdescription.com. The American Indian College Fund supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from DuckDuckGo, who believes AI should be useful, private, and optional. DuckDuckGo offers controls to turn AI on or off. Learn more at DuckDuckGo.com. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Carnegie Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Supreme Court ruled today that a Louisiana prisoner whose dreadlocks were forcibly shaved off cannot sue the guards for money damages through a federal law enacted by Congress to protect the religious rights of prisoners. The vote was 6-3, with the court's conservative supermajority prevailing. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
There's little dispute about the facts of the case. Damon Landor, a Rastafarian, had only 3 weeks left on his sentence when he was transferred to a jail in Louisiana. Although the previous prison where he was housed honored his religious vow of keeping his hair uncut and in long dreadlocks, he was worried that the jail might not. So he carried with him a copy of a 2017 court decision holding that prisons must accommodate the religious practices of Rastafarian prisoners. Landor, it turned out, was right to be worried. The intake guard threw the paper in the trash, and the warden demanded that Landor's sentencing judge had corroborated his religious beliefs. When Landor couldn't do that on the spot, two guards carried him into another room, handcuffed him to a chair, and held him down while they shaved his head. After his release from prison, Landor sued the individual prison guards for money damages under a federal law enacted by Congress to protect the religious rights of prisoners and other institutionalized individuals. But today, the Supreme Court ruled that guards cannot be sued in their individual capacity. Writing for the court's conservative supermajority, Justice Neil Gorsuch said that Congress exceeded its authority in attaching such strings to federal money given to state institutions. The decision focused on the spending clause of the Constitution, which grants Congress the power to give money to the states for particular purposes and to attach conditions to such monetary grants. But as Gorsuch put it in his opinion for the court, such suits cannot be brought against individual state employees without their consent. Put simply, he said, the spending clause is a contract between the state and the federal government. When a state accepts federal money, it knows and accepts the conditions of the money, and if it violates the terms of the contract, the federal government can cease payments. But when it comes to individual lawsuits like this one, he said, the targets of the lawsuit must agree to be sued.
This is a case about the rule of law. Do the laws passed by Congress really bind everybody?
Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman.
The moment you start undermining that principle, there are all kinds of long-term consequences that could eventually, several steps down the road, emerge. In an era where you have ICE officials claiming that they themselves cannot be held liable for violating people's legal and constitutional rights.
More broadly, Feldman says, the decision opens the door to undermining all kinds of laws passed by Congress on everything from civil rights to the environment. For the court's conservatives, today's decision was a fairly dramatic departure from their other decisions on religious matters, in which the court has until now sided with those claiming that their religious rights were violated. In a sizzling dissent for the court's three liberals, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson castigated the majority for diminishing not just individual religious rights, but the power of Congress to legislate. She accused the majority of constructing a sleight of hand that comes by the way of the majority's full-throated endorsement of a contract analogy, even though what secures the rights at issue is not a contract, she said, but a law. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
What to do with all of that extra daylight? Well, you could read some great books that came out this year, and the NPR Books team has you covered. They're out today with a list of the 2026 reads our staff has loved so far. And NPR's Chloe Weiner is here to tell us about some of the fiction on that list. She produces our Book of the Day podcast. Chloe, good to talk to you again.
Hey, Scott.
So let's start with the classic summer genre, romance. It seems like there were a few new romance novels on the list.
You're right about that. Our colleagues have been pretty into romance in the first half of this year. One book our colleagues recommended is Enemies to Lovers by Alicia Rye. This one is kind of an adventure rom-com. It's about an unlikely duo, this guy Krish, who's an upstanding citizen, and a woman named Sejal, who makes a living conning bad men. They team up to solve a crime, and that plays out over a cross-country road trip.
Okay.
There's also The Missed Connection by Tia Williams. Williams is a big contemporary romance author known for writing dynamic characters. She wrote 7 Days in June a few years ago, which was super popular. But this new book is about a woman named Sasha who falls for her seatmate on a plane. And of course, they don't exchange any contact information, kind of a classic setup. So she enlists the help of a detective she knows, and this turns into another romance adventure.
So one of the things I love when our lists come out is the way that you can look at them all together and kind of see some themes that you might be surprised by. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if that happened for you this time around.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I noticed is that a lot of these books involve the idea of returning home or seeing home through new eyes, which I think a lot of us can relate to. One book that definitely follows this thread is Ghost Town by Tom Perata. It's about an older writer who has made it big in his career, and so he gets invited back to his hometown in New Jersey, which he hasn't been back to in like 50 years. And most of the book is about the writer remembering his young life in the 1970s Jersey suburbs and these strip malls where he grew up. And he thinks back to one summer in particular when he was 13, which is when he lost his mom.
Oh, man.
And there are a couple of other books on this list about going home. This one's a pretty big vibe shift. It's called New Skin by Sarah Wang, which is about a woman who goes home to LA to take care of her sick mom. And this kind of spirals out of control. The protagonist's mom is addicted to plastic surgery and ends up competing on a reality TV show. It's all set against the backdrop of LA's beauty industry, which I think is a super interesting setting for a book.
So this is a list of recommendations from all of NPR staff, but I'm wondering about the you list. Like, what is on the Chloe excited to read this summer list?
Thank you for asking. Basically everything on this list, but two stand out. The first is called Last Night in Brooklyn by Sochil Gonzalez. This book has gotten a bit of buzz. It's set in Fort Greene, Brooklyn during a sticky hot summer, and it's been talked about as a kind of modern update to The Great Gatsby. There's gentrification and shifting dynamics in the protagonist's neighborhood, but also parties and this very glamorous neighbor. And then one more. I know you're a politics guy, Scott. Have you heard of this book, Dear Monica Lewinsky?
I actually have not, but I'm curious.
Yeah, it's a funny title. Definitely credit to the author, Julia Langbein, for that one. In the book, it's the summer of 1998, and a college student develops a big crush on one of her teachers. But decades later, she's remembering these feelings and spiraling about them. And there's only one person she can call for advice, St. Monica Lewinsky. I really like the idea of Lewinsky's redemption in our popular culture and in this book.
Interesting. That is NPR's Chloe Weiner, who produces our Book of the Day podcast. Thank you so much, Chloe. It was good to talk to you.
You too, Scott. Thank you.
And you can find more of our staff's favorite reads of the year so far at npr.org/books.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:44. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a moment, North Star Stories produced by Ampers, news from throughout the state of Minnesota. We receive support from Woodworks Homes, dedicated to the art of building in northern Minnesota by constructing handcrafted new homes and offering remodeling services. More at woodworksmn.com. You can rev up your favorite radio station with your car, truck, or boat donation. It is quick, easy, and your unwanted vehicle will be towed away for free. Visit kaxe.org/cars to get started, or call Heather at 218-326-1234 for more information. Chance of rain continues overnight with lows near 50, and tomorrow showers and thunderstorms possible once again with highs in the upper 60s. Lows tomorrow night near 48, and for Thursday, mostly sunny, highs 72 to 75. Time for North Star Stories on KAXE.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
With headlines from around the state, I'm Zan Holston. Coming up...
Tonight, we are calling all champions.
The best of the best are competing for gold in Minnesota at the Special Olympics USA Games. But first...
There could be 300 people in a group, and it takes two people to kind of change the direction of that large group.
Large gatherings of teenagers or young adults organized quickly online are becoming popular on social media and being referred to as teen takeovers. A post about a local hangout spot can bring hundreds of young people to one place in minutes and can become a public safety problem. Carver County Sheriff's Office made a Facebook post about teens gathering in local parking lots. While not using the label teen takeover, the sheriff's office says juveniles are fighting, harassing others, and disrupting businesses. Bloomington Police Deputy Chief Ben Calhoun says this issue is growing, and often people organize the gatherings with criminal motives.
What a lot of times happens is people take advantage of this and use this opportunity to, if the gathering's at a mall, to commit crimes. Overwhelming stores where they can't keep an eye on everybody, and then shoplifting begins to occur.
The former owner of the historic Lutzen Resort on the North Shore wants the arson and insurance fraud case against him dismissed, while prosecutors want some evidence sealed as they fight that request. A Cook County judge told both sides to propose redactions to the evidence materials first. Prosecutors say releasing that information could jeopardize a fair trial. Defense attorneys for owner Bryce Campbell filed a motion to dismiss the entire case. Campbell is accused of arson after the historic lodge burned in February 2024. He faces charges of arson and insurance fraud involving a claim of more than $16.5 million. The judge has not ruled on either motion. Improvements to the aging power infrastructure in northern Minnesota are back on after the Trump administration reinstated federal grant money. Last fall, the administration canceled a federal grant to Duluth-based Minnesota Power for a transmission project line. But now, Minnesota Power says it will get $50 million to modernize power lines running from Hermantown to Center, North Dakota. The utility says the upgrades will help keep costs down. Minnesota's job market is showing a bit of movement, and the state has a new online tool for job seekers. The Department for Employment and Economic Development says Minnesota added 5,400 jobs in May, and unemployment is at 4.4%. The state's new official job search site is now careerforce.mn.gov. It replaces minnesotaworks.net. Job seekers can search openings, build resumes, and sign up for free workshops. Summer is here, and dermatologists say Minnesotans should be taking skin cancer risks seriously. Minnesota ranks second in the nation for melanoma cases, and men are especially at risk as they age. Dr. Mohiba Tareen tells the Public News Service melanoma can show up in places people often miss with sunscreen, including the scalp, ears, and back, and says people should check their skin for
things that are scaly, things that are growing, things that are bleeding, things that are itching and not going away. You should probably have it checked.
Tareen says everyone should wear SPF 30 or higher, wear protective clothing or brimmed hats, and get an annual skin check, especially men over 40 or people with a family history of melanoma. And while you're checking your skin, look for ticks, too. Health officials warn concerns go beyond Lyme disease. The state health department says Minnesota saw a record 14 cases of the tick-borne Powassan virus in 2024, including 3 deaths. Infected deer ticks spread Powassan like Lyme disease, but with more dangerous effects. Severe cases can cause brain or spinal cord inflammation, and there's no cure. Deer tick risk is highest from mid-May through mid-July, especially in wooded or brushy areas. And finally, the Special Olympics are underway in Minnesota and asking its athletes, what's wrong with having confidence?
The answer to that question is crystal clear. Absolutely nothing.
Special Olympics CEO Christy Sovereign spoke to athletes at this weekend's opening ceremony as thousands of competitors from across the country kicked off the games. The events run through this week, with athletes competing in sports from swimming and gymnastics to basketball, track and field, and bocce. Sovereign says the message goes beyond medals. It's about belonging and never apologizing for being confident. For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the State of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This next story, well, it's a story about stories, specifically about the structure of the stories we tell. My guest on this adventure is Ken Adams.
I'm the artistic director of Synergy Theater in Walnut Creek, California.
And an inventor of sorts.
Yes, I am. I invented the story spine, which is an 8-sentence exercise. And the beginning of the sentences are pre-planned, and then the remaining part of the sentences are improvised or created by the storyteller. So those sentence starters are once upon a time, every day, but one day, because of that, because of that, because of that, until finally, and ever since then. So using those sentence starting prompts and completing the sentences, you're able to generate a whole bunch of story spines, which are condensed versions of a well-told story.
Adam says you can apply the story spine to any story, from The Great Gatsby to Star Wars to The Wizard of Oz.
Once upon a time, there was a girl named Dorothy who was whisked away to the magical land of Oz.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Every day, she went on a journey to find the wizard in order to get sent back home. But one day, the wizard told her she would have to destroy the Wicked Witch of the West in order for him to send her home.
Bring me the broomstick of the Witch of the West.
Because of that, she had dangers and adventures.
I'd turn back if I were you.
Because of that, she destroyed the witch and went back to the wizard in order to be sent back home as he promised her, until finally, Toto jumped out of her arms to go chase a cat.
Toto, come back!
And because of that, she missed her opportunity to get sent home. And ever since then, she was rescued by Glinda instead.
There's no place like home.
As for how Ken's invention blew up and why we're talking about it today, well, that's a story too. It starts once upon a time back in the late 1980s.
I was working with an improvisational theater company in New York City called Freestyle Repertory Theater. And we were performing what's known as short form improvisation, short comedic sketches based on suggestions. And at the same time, I was leading a middle school workshop in creative writing. So I needed some type of tool for the kids to use in order to outline their work.
And then one day,
I sat down and figured out, okay, how do stories work? Basically, it's this beginning, middle, and an end. And what is the most condensed version of that I could create?
He rolled it out with the middle school students and in his improv work.
It really worked very well in both situations.
Because of that, Ken was invited to participate in improv festivals all over the country. And because of that,
there was a woman who was one of the founding members of the San Francisco company named Rebecca Stockley. And when I was out there, I taught a workshop. And Rebecca was in the workshop, and I taught the story spine.
Because of that,
Rebecca started using the story spine as she taught.
Until finally,
Rebecca got hired by Pixar to teach improvisation to their writers. And so she went in and taught them a whole bunch of stuff, including the story spine.
And ever since then, story spine has been deeply immersed in all the movies that Pixar makes, including this summer's much-anticipated Toy Story 5.
I do not for one minute think Pixar would be any less successful if this didn't happen. And so this takes nothing away from that at all. The fact that an organization on that level finds value in something I created, I think is awesome.
I just happen to live with an 8 and 3-year-old, and I've watched Toy Story 6,000 times over the past year. So can I do it? And can you correct me if you think I'm doing it the wrong way?
Yes.
So I would say once upon a time, there's a toy named Woody. He's a sheriff, and he lives in Andy's room.
Sheriff Woody.
Every day, he plays with Andy, who he loves very much. Being Andy's favorite toy is the center of his world. But one day, this new toy shows up named Buzz Lightyear.
Buzz Lightyear to Star Command. Come in, Star Command.
Suddenly, Andy is much more excited about Buzz. Because of that, Woody gets jealous of Buzz.
You stay away from Andy. He's mine.
Because of that, Woody tries to push Buzz aside. Because of that, Buzz gets in trouble and leaves the house and ends up in the house across the side of the fence where a kid is really mean to his toys.
He tortures toys just for fun!
Because of that, Woody feels guilty and tries to rescue Buzz. Because of that, they forge a friendship until finally they work together to rescue the toys from Sid's house. Make their way back to Andy's house, and ever since then, they have been at peace with each other.
Woody! Buzz!
Oh, great.
Both being Andy's co-favorite toys, all living together in Andy's bedroom.
Scott, I could not have done that better myself.
I'm going to take a bow. Do you think this works so well because this is the way to tell a good story, or do you think there's part of it that we have all been primed to look for these sort of beats, and a story that sticks to them is going to resonate more because we subconsciously or consciously know what we're experiencing, whether we're reading it or hearing it or watching it?
I would say the story structure is inherent within us. This concept of a beginning and a middle and an end is something we experience every day from the moment we're born a million times. You wake up in the morning, you live your day, you go to sleep at night. So this concept of beginning, middle, end is just deeply embedded in our DNA. And because storytelling is our main source of communicating and satisfies so many needs and basic urges that we have, we apply this beginning, middle, and end structure to it because that's the way we understand life works.
What do you think this need for a beginning, middle, and end, for this kind of structure, what do you think it says about us as humans?
We live in a very chaotic world, and sometimes it is very hard to see the cause and effect relationship between the events we experience. And sometimes there is none. Sometimes good things happen to very bad people, and bad things happen to very good people, and accidents out of the blue come along and destroy your life. And I think when we create stories and we use our understanding of story structure to put events into a beginning and a middle and an end, it allows us some sense of ascendancy over the chaos that we face. So we use our ability to tell stories in order to somehow capture and restrain the chaos and best it so that we have hope that if we continue to live our best life, we will be successful and be able to overcome the relative chaos and meaninglessness that we combat each day.
Ken Adams is the author of How to Improvise a Full-Length Play, The Art of Spontaneous Theater.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BritBox, taking viewers to worlds of drama, romance, and scandal with new original period dramas. Featuring the Other Bennett sister from the world of Jane Austen. Streaming at BritBox.com. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're celebrating 50 years of people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, and you can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. There's another hour of All Things Considered ahead, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And 7, Mike Spry is your volunteer host for On the River. He'll bring you a great mix of music. Lows tonight near 50 with continued chance of rain and possible thunderstorms. Southeast winds gusting up to 15 to 20 miles per hour. Showers and thunderstorms continue tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 60s. And for Thursday, mostly sunny.